Sam was speaking to the first essay in the volume, and Brian and Greg's essay, which is called From Rescue Strategies to Exit Strategies, The Struggle Over Public Sector Austerity, would have been the last essay in the volume, except that we got one from Noam Chomsky, and we decided to put him last, rather than giving Albo and Evans the last word. But they get the last word on this panel.
Chomsky couldn't come.
Unlike Sam, the last time I was in the Lula Lounge, I didn't have to put on a bunny outfit. My partner invited me to come here to learn how to tango or rumba or something like that, and I've never been invited back since, so I didn't do a very good job. Greg and I built our paper around four case studies, looking at, as Leo mentioned earlier, United Kingdom, Greece, Ireland, and the United States. You may ask, okay, why those four? Why not Portugal? Why not Latvia? Why not Iceland, etc.? All fair enough. We agreed on those four, and we could have gone on and added eight or nine others, as you can well imagine. But looking at those four case studies, and I'm going to provide you with a really thin thumbnail overview of what's going on, what happened in each, how we've arrived at the moment that we're in. But before going there, I think there are three general observations that could be applied to each of those and beyond to our own situation here. I'll try and conclude and bring it home to Ontario in 2011 and moving forward to the election in 2011, or October 2011. And one of the most obvious generalizations is that of the political relationship between trade union officialdom and social democratic parties, and if not social democratic parties, parties like the American Democratic Party that proclaim to be pro-labor or have done so historically. And yet again, we've arrived at another moment where that relationship, you would think, would undergo really serious reevaluation. We've had maybe a glimmer of that, but not quite the official break with social democracy many people in the room here have worked and will continue to work for. Secondly, what becomes painfully obvious are, and Sam alluded to it, or in the loop we said it, the real organic political organizational limitations of the anti-neoliberal left and the working class broadly, and how that has effectively, very effectively, limited the ability of the radical left and the working class more broadly to respond to the, I would imagine, the most aggressive austerity measures we've been subjected to in two or three generations. And the third, bit more optimistic, and it's kind of odd coming from me, there are indeed flickers of potential. And we can identify embryonic ideological and organizational movement, or at least thinking, of different ways of realigning and reorganizing to move forward. But like I say, it's flickering, they're embryonic. So I'll jump forward and, again, very quickly move through the UK. What we observe in the UK today really began under New Labour, and in particular, the March 2010 budget, the budget leading up to the election in May that brought the Condem coalition to power. But that budget was an austerity budget. The budget before, in fact, was an austerity budget. But the budget of 2010, after having delivered it, the finance minister, again, I have to just emphasize, a Labour finance minister, said, moving forward toward the election, that whatever may happen, we will have to cut deeper than Thatcher. And that's a verbatim quote. It's not interpreting, it's actually what he said. What began happening after the March 25th budget? A whole series of events that had been building, of course, it didn't happen overnight, but this precipitated the movement forward. British teachers, for the first time in 21 years, had a national, sectoral, general strike. First time in 21 years. In addition to that, lower paid a 500,000 lower paid public sector workers launched three day long, in fact, 1 2-day long, again, sectional general strikes. One of them culminating in a march of 200,000 people. But even with all of that happening, a growing level of militancy, really coming from the rank and file and moving forward, largely, again, it was very, very sectional. It wasn't general, it was sectional. But it became very apparent to many in the labor left that moving to another stage was where they needed to go, another stage politically. Two things happened. The formation or reformation of the trade union coordinating group, eight trade unions who were identified on the labor left, came together again pushing forward, pushing the trade union Congress to move more aggressively against austerity, whether labor-led or whatever the future might bring at that point in time. In addition to that, in fact, shortly before, the organization around the People's Charter, a number of people such as Tony Benn, Ken Loach, many of the notables of the British left, in addition to the trade union left and the Labour Party left, coming together and putting forward for the first time a program that broadly defined as an anti-neoliberal program. But then we jump forward to the election, we know what happened, and the austerity measures of October 2010, which took the equivalent of about 150 billion Canadian dollars out of the British public sector and is forecast to cost 490,000 public sector jobs by 2014. So a number of where the British trade union movement can go from here, it's still unclear. The election of Ed Miliband, of course, marks something. What? We don't quite know. Clearly, drawing the line at New Labour, we are no longer that. But then if you're not New Labour, then what are you? This is an open question. And then within the trade union movement itself, a few interesting developments, the flickers I referred to, such as the election of Len McCloskey, the leadership of Unite, Unite being the largest union in Britain, 1.5 million members. And McCloskey is pushing, and he's not a radical, not known to be a radical, he comes from the mainstream left, but pushing for a more aggressive opposition to austerity. Turning very quickly to Ireland. Ireland's a perfect example of social democratic portrayal at every level, led by the Irish Confederation of Trade Union leadership and the Labour Party. Ireland has endured in a two-year period four austerity budgets, each one leading up to the one in October of 2010, more severe, more aggressive than the one before. Projections are that up to 100,000 public sector jobs will be lost by again 2011 or 2012. Not 2011, 2012, 2013. The key thing, again, more than in Britain, beginning with the first austerity budget in Ireland, the trade union movement, again, coming from the rank and file, there was a movement, again, particularly among teachers, lower-paid public sector workers, to respond. There were waves of very isolated, again, one-day, two-day general strikes throughout the economy. But within a very short period of time, 4-week period, the trade union leadership in the ICTU and the Labour Party, there was a movement, I should say, leading toward a national general strike. The Labour Party leadership and the ICTU leadership said, no, that would accomplish nothing. And in fact, then began renegotiating with the Irish government for a new deal, like the Croke Park deal, which essentially gave the workers nothing. When you boil it all down, it said, if the economy should improve, we'll look at everything over again. The trade unions bought it and went for it. A handful, a minority of unions said no, but they were overwhelmed. So the key point now is a new political formation, the United Left Alliance, bringing together a handful of anti-neoliberal radical parties who are putting forward candidates in the upcoming parliamentary election. Another flicker. Where will it go? What will they accomplish? It's very difficult to tell at the moment, but it's the potential of something different. Turning to the United States, again, much of this is happening at the subnational level. Federal commission, fiscal commission, did recommend a month ago that 1/10 or 200,000 federal public sector jobs be eliminated, and it went on to make another number of recommendations, moving toward more aggressive taxation and privatization. But the real story is happening at the state and local level. California being the best example, but being the best example also harkens back to the signals the limitations of what even the best example can be. And in California, a coalition led by the California teachers, but including a number of public and private sector unions, launched a campaign against the very, very steep budget cuts in California. If you don't know it, California is looking at a budget gap of 58%, meaning they are short in their budget 58% of what they need to pay. The Secretary of Education for the state of California a week ago said to the media, they're no longer sure if California can afford public education. Hyperbole maybe, but it signals what we're up against. The coalition that the teachers brought together put forward a broader agenda. We wouldn't call it anti-neoliberal, but it put forward an agenda against privatization, against cuts in healthcare, social welfare, and trying to reach out to other communities which weren't teachers, weren't public sector workers. It appeared to have a little bit of gravity, but now, for nearly 5 months, they've not moved forward at all. They've gone into stasis. And again, given what they're confronting, and with a budget coming, that's not the time to let it go and relax, you would think. Bill Fletcher, has made a comment that, in part of the problem in the trade union leadership comes down to two things: a real lack of political vision and imagination, and two, an ongoing fidelity to the Democratic Party. In the midterm congressional elections gone by, American trade unions contributed $88 million to Democratic Party candidates. A good investment or not, one is left to wonder. And finally, turning to Greece, and I'll be very quick. Maybe the best example of militant working class opposition resistance to, again, a very aggressive program of austerity. They've had, in 2010, there were 15 national general strikes, in addition to hundreds upon hundreds. In fact, nobody's actually quite sure how many local and sectional one-day work actions. Now, you would think that's indicative of something major happening, but in fact, it actually signals real limitations, because none of this has been particularly effective in rolling the agenda back. And that, in part, is due to political limitations. The KKE, the Communist Party of Greece, is horribly sectarian. Its trade union front, which brings together nearly 500,000 Greek workers, will not cooperate with the Social Democratic-led General Confederation trade unions, or with the trade union confederation representing public sector workers. And then the other layer being sectional sectarianism, being that between the public and private sector confederations, they also have difficulty working with each other, collaborating with each other. So at one level and another, you have militant working class organizations, you have several parties that we would put on the anti-neoliberal left, but yet unable to work together. And bringing it all together, the local elections only a couple months ago, you think that would have been a major breakthrough, should have been an example of a major breakthrough. But in fact, quite the opposite. Well, the left, broadly defined, not including PASOK, obtained 1 vote in 5. The real winner, was the KKE. Their vote went up by 3%, totaling 10.9%. Hardly a breakthrough. And there were a few regions where they did better, but even the combined left vote never went much higher than 42% of the vote. That was in one region near Athens. The big story in the Greek local elections was the number of people who abstained didn't bother. Overall, 47%. And in Athens, 57%. Just didn't bother to vote. Now, that could be an opportunity, but clearly, looking at the radical left is not seen to be an alternative, not yet, if you look at those kinds of numbers. And the other footnote to that being, where people did vote, the big winners were people who were not identified with any political party. They did phenomenally well. Now, to wrap up and conclude and bring that all back to Ontario, we've watched the provincial government attempt to negotiate a wage freeze back in August, September, and October. We all know that came to nothing. And then the question becomes, why did they begin that process? And then why did it? Why was it allowed to come to nothing? And there are a couple of observations from that, one of which being the incredible weakness of our own trade union movement, working class broadly, the fact that our own Social Democratic Party is no longer particularly relevant, has actually fed into much of the political calculation the Ontario trade union leadership are making now, which is, and people have commented and told me this, when they were at the table and when they would meet with government representatives, that in fact the NDP are no longer a factor. We fear what a Tory government might do, and therefore we are prepared to make a deal, any kind of a deal, even one off the radar, with the McGuinty Liberal government. It doesn't mean signing on to a wage freeze, but it also signals why the McGuinty government didn't more aggressively pursue a wage freeze and move to perhaps legislative intervention. But again, that one remains to be seen, and as one senior person at the Ontario Finance Ministry said to me, whatever happens on election night in October, we're going to have to cut and cut deep. Thank you.
Great.